Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, shalom, everyone. This is Yaina Yael. I'm going to open up the mic for Prince Asiel, and so we can go forward with his show. One moment.
Shalom,
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 shalom, sir. Are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful, wonderful. How are you today?
Extraordinary, Yaina. And I'm real happy about today's program and today's guest. I want to check and see if Dr. Kobe is on the line yet. Dr. Kobe?
Not yet. Nope, not yet, sir, but we're waiting. Would you like for me to play a song while you contact your guest and everything?
Yeah, go right ahead.
All right, one moment.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother,
there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and tears here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on?
Right now.
Prince Asiel, how are you today?
Extraordinary, sis, and feeling real good and energized. So maybe while we're waiting for the doctor to call in, I can have his bio read to you so that the listening audience can see the kind of guest that we got today. He's a black African-centered psychologist, and I think his history at a all-black university, FAMU, sort of speaks for itself. I'm going to have one of my readers read it for you.
Okay, wonderful.
Good evening.
Shalom, shalom.
Ken Bond is a distinguished educator, author, psychologist, therapist.
We can't hear it. We can't hear it.
Researcher in the areas of African black psychology, black personality and mental health, and cultural oppression. Is a retired professor of psychology from the Department of Psychology at Florida A&M University, where he served as a department chair and coordinator for the Community Psychology Graduate Program over a 30-year career. He chaired the department for some 12 years, from 1985 to 1997, and is credited with establishing the international renowned African Center emphasis and leading it become one of the most productive psychology departments for African descendants and the students of this country. During his tenure at FAMU, psychology department was one of the number one producers of the African-American bachelor's degrees, as well as the number one producer of the doctorate recipients in psychology among non-doctorate degree-granting institutions in the country. Several of his former students have become prominent psychologists and educators in their own right, and he has well over 60 scholarly publications.
Hold on, we can't hear. Put the volume up.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Hello?
Hello? I think Prince Hafiyonin will be right with us. They may be having some technical difficulties. Hello? All right, we have, we're waiting on them to call back in. And I think his guest is here as well. Sir, if you could hold on one moment. We're waiting on Prince Haciel to call back in for the show, and then we will open your mic back up. All right, I see they're here. One moment. Here we go.
Back. Can you hear me?
Okay, Prince. Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. We're going to start again, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Dr. Ken Bond is a distinguished educator, author, psychologist, and researcher in the areas of African black psychology, black personality, and mental health, and cultural oppression. He is a retired professor of psychology from the Department of Psychology at Florida A&M University, where he served as department chair and coordinator of the Community Psychology Graduate Program for over 30 years. He chaired the department for 12 years, from 1985 to 1997. And is accredited with establishing the renowned African Center emphasis and leading it to become one of the most productive departments of African descent students in this country. During his tenure, the FAMU Psychology Department was the number one producer of the bachelor's degrees for that department, as well as the number one producer of doctorate recipients in psychology among the non-doctorate degree-granting institutions in the country. Several of his former students have become prominent psychologists and educators in their own right. He has well over 60 scholarly productions and publications and is author of some of several books and several widely used black personality and mental health assessment instruments. His latest book, Cultural Misorientation and Psychology of Impression, The Greatest Threat of the Survival of the Black Race in the 21st Century, is the second one of his textbooks to give going to second edition, and is due for release around January 2015. The other book is the widely acclaimed text, African Black Psychology. In the American context, the African-centered approach, he has also been a past president of Associate of Black Psychologists and a diplomat and fellow in African-centered psychology, and is one of the most has won numerous awards and recognitions for professional, educational, and student and community organizations, both domestically as well as internationally, for his contributions to African black psychology and black community development in general. He earned a bachelor arts degree in psychology from DePaul Chicago University and a master's of arts degree in personal Abnormal Psychology from Roosevelt Chicago University, and a PhD in Personality and Social Psychology from the University of Colorado in Boulder. He is a native of Jasper, Alabama, and currently resides in Tallahassee, Florida. He is also available for book signing, expert consultations on Black mental health programs and services, Black community program development, intervention and prevention services, and African Black studies programming. He is also available for speaking engagements on college campus and throughout the Black community on a variety of topics and issues related to Black-centered psychology. He can be contacted at kkkkamboon@aol.com. Once again, the email address is kkkkamboon@aol.com.
I'm honored to have such a distinguished, not only revolutionary in changing the behavior and the thinking of African people in America, but in the world. And so, can I check now to see if the doc is online?
Yes, sir. One moment here. We have area code 805. Sir, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello.
Doc, how are you today?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. I hope that we hit the high points of your distinguished career and service to your people and to the world in America. Doc, joining me hosting you is Sister Yaina, who is the head of the Yehuda Nation and the Yehuda Project. As I said to you yesterday, as you know, my background is in the internationalization of African people to become sovereign of their own destiny. And we chose the direction of the prophetic, going all the way back to those biblical personalities such as Moses, Solomon, and the prophets of the biblical narrative, as our bloodline connected directly to our spiritual and historical bloodline. And nothing would be better for me to say to you, as we build this better world, that you come in with giving us a new mind. Because one of the things that our history has taught us is that as we begin to build a better world, we will get a new mind, a new brain. And most people don't know or understand that the body has two brains. It has one in the cranium and one in the heart. And the heart brain, because it's the first organ in the body in the fetus to develop, most people leave their heart brain to logic, which is the Greek how to look at things. But because we are spiritual people, we're bringing it back to the heart. And so, Doc, I want you to know that we are ready to hear your presentation, and we'll go from there. Dr. Kobe.
Let me, first of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that on this Saturday, the 26th, I think, of July, I'll be conducting a workshop on cultural misorientation and the psychology of oppression at the Jacob H. Carruthers Center for Inner City Studies in Chicago as part of the Communiversity's offering this Saturday from, I think, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. This Saturday in Chicago, Illinois, for those people who are listening in your audience who are from Chicago. So I wanted to make sure I got that in.
Thank you, Doc, and I would be remiss if I did not recognize the fact that you journeyed to Chicago for this presentation. And I want to say something about your primary teacher, Dr. Bobby Wright. If you will give us a little background about him as you go into the work that you continued under
his,
I would be more than honored so that our people know that Dr. Bobby Wright was premier in this arena.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I certainly was a student of Dr. Bobby Wright. I met Dr. Wright when I was in undergraduate school. here studying psychology in, at DePaul University. And I attended his class on the psychology of black nationalism, taught at the community university in Chicago in the late 1960s through the 70s, along with many other, you know, young up-and-coming, you know, scholars, critical thinkers, and nationalists, and, et cetera. Of course, we were in the same field, and so I got to know Bobby personally. I worked for him at the Garfield Park Comprehensive Community Mental Health Center, collaborated with him in the African Psychology Institute, the early African Psychology Institute we started in the late 70s under his leadership, and also collaborated with him in the National Association of Black Psychologists. So we had a long history of a relationship in terms of that. As a matter of fact, my first publication, Bobby was responsible for it, in 1976, when the Association of Black Psychologists held its national convention in Chicago. Bobby was authorized by Black Books Bulletin to organize a special issue on black psychology. And Bobby asked me to prepare a piece for that edition. And it was really when I first formally entered the discourse on African-centered psychology, you know, the national and international discourse, with that article, and it became the lead article in that particular special issue of the Black Books Bulletin back in 1976. I could go on and on. I can remember standing over his body at his funeral back in 1982 and making a solemn commitment to him that we would continue his work and make sure that we established an African-centered psychology that would have global import for our people. And we had to have a special election because he was the president-elect of the Association of Black Psychologists at the time that he made his transition. And so we had to hold a special election to fill his seat after he transitioned. And I ran and was elected as the new president of the Association of Black Psychologists to fulfill Bobby's term. So the stars were aligned to make sure that we continued his work through that organization as well as through my own work.
Well, Doc, I'm not only honored and impressed that you had the courage, continuity, and the intellect to continue the vision. Would you first, in a black-centered, African-centered psychology for our listening audience?
Certainly. And I want to also mention that textbook on African black psychology, it's dedicated to Bobby. Because had he lived, I'm sure that he would have been the author of the first definitive textbook on African black psychology in the American context. But, yeah, in terms of African-centered psychology, it's a system of knowledge, you know, that obviously any system of knowledge that's substantive also represents a system of understanding and application. So it's a system of knowledge of the African psychological reality in America, throughout the diaspora, and in implications for in Africa or globally, it uses conceptual framework the African worldview and the African survival thrust, as I refer to it. And so the African black psychology, by definition, comes into being in response to not only the oppressive condition of black people, but the natural condition of black people to self-affirm, to self-empower, and to exert, you know, African-centered reality for African people. And so ultimately that's what African black psychology is about, African empowerment in every aspect of life, not only psychologically, but of course psychologically then is tied to all other aspects of, you know, any expressions of being, an African human being. I hope that wasn't too complicated.
No. That was a great foundation for the discussion that we want to have. In your latest writing and your textbook approach to this particular subject matter,
mm-hmm.
what is it that you emphasize as a teacher, a scholar, and as an author? What point are you trying to get the reader, the listening audience, to get from your presentation?
Okay.
That will help them get the correct mm-hmm. worldview of themselves.
Okay. Yeah, there are several key issues that I'm trying to establish in the conceptual universe of the reader, the African reader, of course. One is that I'm trying to establish in the conceptual universe of our readers that human beings have the power to define their own reality. But if we don't control our own mentation, then we won't exercise that natural, or if you will, God-given power to define our own reality. That means someone else is going to exercise it for us on our behalf. And if they don't have our best interest at heart, then they're going to define reality in a way that maintains their domination over us, and we're going to maintain our subjugation to their domination. So the power to define reality is one critical component of African-centered psychology as I present it and want our people to understand. We indeed have the power to define our reality. And so what we need is we must have the African-centered knowledge base so that that definition of reality is consistent with our empowerment as a racial, cultural entity or collective. And so issue number one is the power and the power to define reality, our reality, and that reality should be defined in a way that addresses our affirmation, in the case of oppression, our vindication, and ultimately our, you know, in terms of our reestablishing an African world order to preserve, protect, and secure, you know, Africa's future, African people's future, you know, on planet Earth. So that's very important. The second issue that I want to establish in my readership of, in terms of African-centered psychology, is that we have to understand that the worldview's paradigm is a critical foundation for what I call African-centered critical thinking. That if we're going to think in a way that is consistent with the empowerment of our race, our culture, even in a world, you know, a globe dominated by white supremacist domination, then we must reconstruct a reality that is consistent with our existence as African people. And so we must understand the African worldview, that is the worldview that is naturally defines us and our empowerment, as well as the European or the Caucasian worldview, the worldview that currently dominates the societal organizational structure of the world by, you know, what we call white people or Caucasianism. And so we must understand the European or Caucasian worldview as well as the African worldview, because we are entrapped in the Caucasian worldview as a result of their domination, you know, through military conquest and colonialism, enslavement, et cetera. And so they have been able to erect their worldview as the worldview for humanity. And because in reality that worldview is about empowering, maintaining the system of white domination, of white, you know, white rule and domination over African people and everybody else on the planet for that matter. But in terms of, in our case, it's our responsibility to deal with our people first and our survival. And so we're concerned about the fact that this Caucasian worldview is designed to dominate our people. And so we must understand our own worldview, the African worldview, so that we can understand where ours end and theirs began. Because what happens in oppression is they're able to superimpose their worldview or cultural reality on African people, and then we become entrapped in their worldview and operate on their worldview as if it is our natural worldview as African people. And that's going to get us in serious trouble, as all the evidence around us clearly, you know, demonstrates. You know, when we are locked into somebody else's definition of reality, their cultural reality, and they have taught, brainwashed us to accept that as our natural, it's the world, the reality that we should all be operating in, then we're in trouble. So excuse me. And the second issue of my work, as I call the worldview's paradigm, the importance of that is to distinguish between their cultural reality and our cultural reality, so that we can have clear parameters for when we're operating in a normal natural sphere for African or black people, as opposed to or as contrasted with the normal natural sphere defined by Eurocentrism or Caucasianism or white supremacy domination. And so I call it understanding racial cultural relativism. And when we understand that, we'll know, will it be able to operate in a way that we can distinguish theirs from ours? And when when theirs is encroaching upon us, the proper alarm systems will go off, and we will be able to defend ourselves, you know, from becoming engulfed and brainwashed and miseducated and all those other things that they do to control the thinking and behavior of black people and maintain the system of oppression. I hope that was, you know, clear enough that to really get a gist of. So those are two critical issues that I'm trying to get across to my readership in the scholarly work that I've been engaged in. And I think that when people read my work, the intellectual outcome I want them to leave it with is what I call this intellectual competency that I call African critical thinking and analysis. They should be able to engage it and to apply it and to be able to function in a way that maintains the empowerment of African people and to sustain it and secure it, you know, protect it, et cetera, and expand it, you know, in a world that secures African survival.
One of the things that I want to point out, as you begin to develop this African-centered cultural look at the brain, the mind, and the culture, there was a writer of history, Chancellor Williams, Destruction of the Black Civilization. How important is his work on what you're doing? And did you have an opportunity to meet him?
Absolutely. In both cases, yeah. His work is so critical. It was so refreshing in the early 70s to read a historian who not only understood history, but it came through so clearly that he loved our people. You see, when you become a scholar, that shouldn't require you to give up who you are. You know, Europeans have us, you know, chasing these false, you know, images of what it means to be a human being and what it means to be a thinker, you know, what it means to be anything for that matter. And so they have us believing in all this hocus pocus stuff about, you know, the experimenter who becomes objective when he puts on the magic spot. You know, the magic smock, and he goes into his laboratory, and now he leave all his biases at the door, and now he's a, you know, objective vessel of truth and so on and so forth. You know, of course, we know that's bullshit, you know, literally, you know. But, I mean, you can get mesmerized by that as a young, you know, developing mind, you know, and it throws you off track, and you have to go and spend a lot of years openly discovering that that was all, you know, a smokescreen. It had nothing to do with it. It was about maintaining the status quo of white domination. So I think Dr. Chancellor Williams, when he wrote that book, he was one of the first historians I ever read who then not only gave us the history, but he gave us an analysis of the history, and he gave us an analysis that was consistent with the empowerment of African people. And so he had a tremendous impact on me and my thinking, and I did have the honor of sharing the podium with him back in 1983, before he transitioned, I think in 84, 85, somewhere in there. And while I was the president of the Association of Black Psychologists, and he was our keynote speaker at our 1984 convention. And he, you know, he indicated that he had stopped taking a lot of invitations to come out and speak because he was suffering from glaucoma and some other health issues. And so he was very careful and deliberate about when he accepted, you know, presentations or the invitations to present. But he said that when he got the invitation from the black psychologist, he said he had to respond to that one. He said, because in all of his studies of the history of African people, he said, at the core of our problem of oppression was psychological, and therefore we needed psychologists to respond to that issue. And so he came to the convention off of his sick bed to make sure he gave us our charge for the future and the salvation of our people, that we must step up to this fight because of the intellectual and conceptual tools that we were supposed to have as psychologists to lead our people out of this morass of Eurocentric, you know, menticide and cultural misorientation, you know, the psychological brainwashing, miseducation that oppression ultimately imposes upon black people. So yeah, I have that one moment in the sun. The ancestors blessed me with that fleeting moment of being in his presence and being able to share ideas with him and to learn from this great sage of our people before he transitioned.
And I wanted the listening audience to know that not only did you write the textbook on psychological change that needed to be made for African people, you studied the history and why it came about. And under Dr. Chancellor Williams, we realized a couple of things. I want to go back to your Black Book Bulletin article on the black, and that was in 76, you said, right?
Yes.
And in 77, Brother Mabuti, who is the founder of Third World Press and Black Book Bulletin, I had the pleasure of meeting him and traveling to Africa with him so that he would understand the African presence in Northeast Africa, which is called the Holy Land. And I took him and one of his colleagues to Israel, because part of the damage was that the world had been taught that the people of the Holy Land, Israel, were a European people. And so this was part of the destruction of that black intellectual base that could validate and verify. And I had the great honor of meeting the late Tidiane Tadia out of Senegal when I went to the University of Senegal. He was an Egyptologist as well as one of those scholars who went to validate and verify what we were saying about the black presence of greatness in Africa. And so
Absolutely.
When I talked to him, I asked him about the biblical Israelites. And he said, absolutely, they were black. And I could validate it and prove it scientifically. And so all of this on my journey to realize that I was not just talking religion, but I was talking historical and factual reality from a prophetic scientific point of view, so that we as a people wouldn't be speculating whether God was the God of Africa or God was sympathetic to black people or black people were simply just following a Eurocentric religion. And when we got this kind of proof, Hakim Mabuti published in 77 Black Africans and Jews as the cover story, and he interviewed me and out of the world, that reality. And I want to just take a moment to say, too, also was taught by the late Dr. Bobby Wright. He was my friend, my brother, and I honor and respect him. These are the great spirits, as you said correctly, of the ancestors that touched me. And I also met Dr. Chancellor Williams in Washington, D.C., as he was getting to his last years. But I had a chance to ask him questions, and he then said he rewrote his book because he didn't start off with the premise that the people of the Bible were an African people. But his later writings reflected that change, and I'm eternally grateful for one of the foremost principal historians of Africa and African people was able to put that out there. And the reason that I say that is that this program, and my co-host on this program of A Better World and the Yehuda Nation, I'll introduce her a little later in the program so that she will be able to continue to provide this kind of history and information to her listening audience so that they can stand strong as African Hebrews that it's based on fact and not fiction. So let me take this moment, Doc, for you to go on and speak to what you want to talk about this Saturday coming so that the people that's listening out of Chicago and nearby can come in and get the workshop and the lecture.
Okay. Yeah, the central premise of the what I call the cultural misorientation paradigm, that the central premise of that is that African people, you know, black people in the diaspora as well as in Africa, for that matter, and globally, because whether we want to acknowledge it or not, there is a Caucasian world order that have been imposed upon the globe, upon, you know, the world, planet Earth. And we have to deal with that. You know, Bobby taught us that years ago. We got to deal with that. When we have this anti-African force, you know, organizing, you know, structuring the world, the globe, around, you know, maintaining the status, you know, this subjugated status of African people. If not, you know, totally destroying African people physically. But I think that this cultural misorientation paradigm that I've developed is really trying to explain how African people can be out of our African mind and not know it and function as if we are normal people, because the society itself is structured around our being out of our African mind. So that's kind of, you know, maybe a mouthful of complexity, but if it is that the society that we live in is structured, is based on, it's, you know, originates in the European worldview or the Caucasian worldview. And so, therefore, it's designed to reinforce psychological Caucasianism or psychological white supremacy or white psychological white domination or psychological Europeanism or Eurasianism. So, therefore, that means for black people to operate in a way in this society that leads to whatever material rewards and whatever other kind of reward or reinforcement that they control, that we have to get in line psychologically with that expectation, the expectation of that European or Caucasian survival thrust. And so psychologically, cultural misorientation simply means or is defined as the fact of black people operating with a European survival thrust, you know, operating from the European worldview, or have internalized the European worldview, operating according to European cultural reality. And therefore, some people call it internalized racism, but it's much more than that. It's that it encompasses that. But it's their values, their whole system, their way of construing reality is what we have been brainwashed to. So not just being anti-black and whatever, that's a poor part of it, but it's also seeing the world the way they see it in every other respect. Yeah, operating on that perception as if it is natural to us rather than one that has been imposed upon us. And, of course, initially
a couple of examples of that.
A couple of examples, of course. We can use examples of our alien names, you know, that they impose their reality on us by naming us, you know, and, you know, on the plantation, you know, they may call us John, and that was it, a first name, or they call us the N-word. And if they were looking at you and use the N-word, that meant they were talking to you, you see. And so, therefore, that becomes a part of your reality. But, you know, but more and more commonly, that was common, too. I don't want to suggest that wasn't. But benign, I guess, was the fact that, you know, we'd have their language names. And so they imposed these names up on us, forced them to us. And then we adopted them over time as if they were our natural, you know, racial cultural reality. And so to the degree that we name our children those names, and they name their children those names, and we continue to perpetuate this false reality of alien names, you know, for African people. And so, you know, names are a personal reference for you. And so, therefore, our personal reference is already off kilter, because we got a name that relates us to the Irish or the Italians or the so on and so forth. And we don't seem to see a contradiction or a paradox in that. In other words, the society is organized in such a way that it leads us to believe that's okay. They don't create, there's no stink, there's no disruption created about that that's normal for black people to walk around with these Caucasian names and to see each other and to perpetuate them as a part of their reality. You know, other things, their music, the stuff the values that they preference, the mythology that they practice. you know, that we internalize these things as if they are natural for us, because the social order, the defining forces in the society or in the institution of the society tell us it's okay. Tell us it's okay. The only you know, we get a little gross, you know, indicator of it, like a person like Michael Jackson, the late entertainer. Now, Michael Jackson acted, you know, in a very bizarre way publicly. But it's because he had the money, he had the material resources to do that. I suggest that a lot of black people had the Michael Jackson predisposition, but they didn't have the material resources to show that how crazy they could be. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that that's another example of what I call cultural misorientation, is that when we all tolerated it. I really let our children have Michael Jackson posters in their room, you know, like a role model, this imagery, this icon, you know, in our people, just because he could sing well and capture our spirit with his talent. He was out of his African mind in terms of how he projected himself. And so nobody was trying to put him in a straitjacket or take him to the hospital like we do with people who are crazy. You know, he was making more money, and we were paying all kinds of money to go see him, and so on and so forth. So I'm saying that's how cultural misorientation operates as a very sinister kind of phenomenon, because it's everywhere, and so nobody attached any significance to it because everybody's doing it, and so that's what makes it so dangerous. It's so commonplace in our reality of oppression that nobody seeks to recognize it for the mental disorder, psychological disorder that it truly is. So, you know, and I could give others, you know, the problem we have with our hair, you know, and those kind of things, and, you know, and our self-presentation, we all want to integrate. We think that things are not legitimate unless they somehow involve some Caucasians or non-blacks. You know, and so if they got them involved, then if it's legitimate, we'll all put our energy into it and join it and so on and so forth and what have you.
No, Doc, I think those were perfect examples of that cultural disorientation. And I want to chime in by saying when I decided that I was going to pursue the history that was relevant to me and a significant number of our people in America, I went back to the fundamental principle that God, Africa was the cradle of civilization, God had to be a special relationship to African people. And that people that he had a special relationship was called the African Hebrews. And so you're right. My name became Asiel Ben Israel, and my title as a servant to my God and my people became Prince. So it wasn't just royalty when they called me Prince, but it elevated me to degree of servant. And then Asiel means he whom God has created. And Ben Israel means he that has power, a son that has power with man and with God. So whenever I would walk into a room and they say, well, what's your name? And then I'll tell them, and they say, no, your other name. I say, I don't have any other name. And then all of my children, I went on to name them the attributes R.L., Angel of God. I wanted the people to see a real living African that was an angel. And that meant to have the ability to understand the mysteries of the creation. And my next son was living water. We talk about Run, Jordan, Run, but there is a spiritual river that have taken us all of these millenniums that continue to flow in our mind and our spirit, and you captured it, Doc, in the whole psychological understanding of cultural disorientation. And my son named Yosef, Yusuf, the one that went into Egypt and had power with the captives of our people in Egypt, and God gave him power to not only liberate his captives, but to continue to lift up his people and save his people, because went and made a way in ancient Egypt the same way that you are making a way in modern Egypt called America. And then my last son was, I still endure and persevere and continue to serve God. The struggle continues and we won't stop. So all of these African names that I've given these boys, young men, reflect what you just said. And that becomes important because this program is designed to resuscitate and resurrect the mind that's been asleep, that the scriptures talk about, the dry bones. Can those bones live? And you're an indication that they can, Doc, and I want to continue to thank you so that I don't take advantage of you, and I want to take advantage of using as much time as I can. But I want to have you speak to the co-host with me, Sister Yanina, who will talk about the Yehuda Nation and the Yehuda Project. And I want you to know that we are looking forward to inviting you out to speak to congregations and delegations as we go forward. Sister Yanina.
Yes, sir. How are you? I'm right here. I think that it was wonderful. I enjoyed every bit of it. I just have a question, though, because when you talk about the state of the black people and the mind of the black people, when you deal with cultural assimilation, you know, that is exactly what we deal with every day, especially coming from a female, a black female standpoint. You know, we are basically obsolete, out of view, taken completely out of the way, where the Caucasian female has dominated the media, the radio, all over, billboards, everything you see. So, you know, I completely concur with everything that you're saying. We just have to find a way to be able to reach our people, and our young people especially, to be able to capture their minds back, because their minds are just gone. They have just taken them in a whole other direction.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's not an accident that we see all the chaos around us and our children. It's not an accident. We exist under oppression, and oppression is very complicated. And so, you know, we have to design institutions that are going to re-socialize and re-educate our people, you know, to their own cultural reality, because there's so much, you know, misinformation, propaganda, noise out there in the universe, you know, designed to knock them, you know, off of their correct orientation. And it's, of course, it's supported by the, you know, the formal school system and all those things. They all teach Caucasianism or Caucasian cultural reality. And so we're there, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And I think that our young people remind us almost every day by the bizarre things that they do, you know, the anti-African, anti-black things that they do all the time. They remind us of this fact that we've got work to do. There's still a lot of work that we have to do if we are going to regain control over the definition of our own, defining our own reality as African people, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I had a young man call me. Well, he's in his 40s, but he called me on yesterday, and he said, you know, what's the point? I listen to Prince Asiel's show, and it's kind of outdated because I'm in Chicago. People are getting killed every day. We need to know how to reach these young people right now, and something needs to be done, you know. So from that standpoint, you know, I had to let him know, you know, that we can't save everybody. Everybody's not going to make it. But we have to put forth an effort to try to reach our children, because that's our culture, and that's our future. If we don't do anything about that, I mean, we're just pretty much washed up. And the Most High said
Absolutely.
That would not happen, you know. So
Absolutely.
We have to
Absolutely.
Do something.
Yeah, I plan to spend a little time on that on Saturday about, you know, our charge, what our charge must be to our children. See, because that's really the bottom line. That's the real issue, as you said in your statement. We have no future if we don't secure that of our children. And so I think that there's certain things that a community must do if they love their children. You see, if they really, then they must assume a responsibility to protect their children. And protecting our children means to make sure they get properly educated, not miseducated. Protecting our children means that they, you know, they have to be, you know, cared for from the womb, you know, right on up. You know, they have to get the proper service and care, you know, and social response from our institutional response from our community. So I think that there's so much that we must do. But the first thing we have to do is reorient ourselves, you see.
That's true.
The adult population, as many of them as we can, we must reorient them because they are the people who really, you know, impress upon our children this cultural misorientation. And so they have to be a target. At least those who have influence over our children, they must be targeted, you know. And we must do like the teachers, you know, the other people in leadership and role modeling positions in our community. Then we have to challenge them, you see, because
absolutely.
We can't let them be agents of our oppression. You know, we cannot afford, you know, that, you know.
The reason that I bring personalities like yours on, I'm really talking to that young man's parents, because in 1991, I was part of the organizing team that brought 16 of the street gangs in the city of Chicago to the table. And for the first time in the history of Chicago, every member of the Vice Lords and the DD and the BD could go any place in the city and not be attacked. There was no violence. And so I wanted to remind them by bringing men like yourself, even though you have retired, your mind and brain and experience haven't retired. That's why it's so important that they come out and hear you, because you can connect the dots for them. So the young man, because he has no sense of history of who I am or who I was during those days when it was murder at 1,000 black boys and girls a year, excuse me, in the city of Chicago, we out there front line walking at night when the project was all up and down State Street in Chicago and the west side, the Henry Horner home. We brought all of the top men out in that day through the streets and with the people. And we visited every major prison in the state of Illinois and went in and talked to the leaders. We talked to Larry Hoover of the GD. We talked to Jordy Freeman of the BD. We talked to Chico of the Vice Lords. We talked to the generals at the L. Rukin. We know the root, and so we're trying to give the children the fruit of our labor and make them understand the bitter fruit or the strange fruit that Billie Holiday sung about and made famous when she saw that man hanging from the tree. There were 3,000 lynchings over a 30-year period in the 20s and 30s that black boys and girls have forgot who the original real enemy was when Elijah Muhammad painted that picture for white racism to the core that he connected it to evil. So we're not anti anybody. We just pro information that would sustain and correct and free us. And you are giant in that area, Doc.
I say. Absolutely.
So let me go right ahead, my sister.
Prince Osseo, you have someone that pushed one. Would you like for me to open up their mic?
Please open up their mic and let them speak.
Okay. All right. Area code 202, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to extend peace and blessings to everyone. This is Prince El Ram, members of A Better World, and I just wanted to call in and thank the doctor, first of all, for giving us this life-saving and eye-opening information, but also for maintaining and lifting up and honoring Dr. Bobby Wright, who was very instrumental in Chicago and helping a lot of people get on this path, myself being one of them. So I am more than happy to hear his name mentioned and that someone is honoring him for the great man that he was and the great work that he did. And, Doc, I'd like to ask you a question in terms of some of us like to believe, you know, that we're conscious, we're on the right path, that we got it, that we're clear, you know. But I see it as us being possessed by so many demons that sometimes we deceive ourselves and we need an exorcism or we need, you know, we need radical surgery where you got to cut until you make sure that all of the ailment, infection, or disease is gone. And this homegrown terrorism that's been waged on us has certainly fashioned us in a manner where we're not even aware of how oppressed we are, how our behavior is so anti-us, how it is actually by definition insane, but we convince ourselves that we got it over the next man, or we understand better, or maybe some of us in various so-called positive or African-centered movements think that we are okay, think that we have it made. So if you could just give us some simple things that we can do and what we need to do continuously to not only to fight these demons but to win, you know, because
I hear you.
I mean, it's not easy wrestling and changing your mind and then having people looking at you and actually saying that there's something wrong with you because you did.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I and I'll probably mention some of this on Saturday, too, at the program. But, you know, I have mentioned in various presentations I've given around the country, you know, about the fact that there are, you know, I've been on programs where other African-centered speakers have been there and, you know, they get up and they pontificate on the various subjects that they're talking about and so on and so forth. Because I entered this movement when I was very young, and I was a keen observer. I was trying to find out what was going on, what was going down, and where the contradictions were. You know, I could see the hustlers from the other folks. You know, I could differentiate because I could see what people's games were. There were a lot of gamers, you know, in this movement, and still are for that matter. You know, people who are out there to get something else out of it, to hustle it rather than because they love our people and trying to save our people. You know, they got another agenda. But in terms of what I was just saying, I said one thing, it was coming across to me, and I think this was in Chicago at one presentation I gave at the Transatlantic Slavery Program that they had at the center in about 2007. And I said, you know, I said one thing that concerns me is when our African-centered scholars get up before our people, and they begin to speak in a way that is like they're talking down to our people. You know, it's like they're on this lofty plateau or whatever, and everybody else is, you know, helped up and that kind of thing. You know, so, and they got the magic something. And I said, you know, I think that we should use a model like AA, you know, or the AAA, whatever, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they got this model where every time they have a meeting, if you're going to get up to speak to them, the first thing you have to do is declare, I'm an alcoholic, you know, and I'm going to try to get out of this stuff. But I, first of all, I'm going to let you know I'm starting from the same place everybody else is I'm talking to. And I really think that if you understand this condition I call cultural misorientation, you'll understand that nobody escapes from it. It's like an umbrella that comes with oppression. You know, it's all institutions are pushing it. And so we get it from the time we leave our mother's breast. You see, they start working on us. You know, it's like, you know, if you imagine some of these futuristic movies and where they talk about electrodes coming in your head, you know, with, you know, Caucasian reality, it's all around us. Once we step outside the house, you know, they attack us psychologically. And so, therefore, I said, so maybe what we should do when we get up before our people, one requirement should be that we get up and declare that we recognize we're in the same boat. In other words, say, I'm a victim of white supremacy domination, and I'm committed to fighting it with my last breath. You know what I'm saying? Now I can go on and tell you whatever I got to tell you. Because I've let you know that I recognize that we're all in this, and this is a ritual that's required of all of us. Every day, remind ourselves. You know, as Dr. Frances Welsing, the distinguished Dr. Frances Welsing used to say in her presentation, she said, you should wake up every day and look around and say, damn, the white man is still in charge. It gives you a bearing on reality. In other words, I better not act a fool today because he's still in charge. So
that's
I better
right.
be careful. I better keep my eyes open. Better be, you know, vigilant and so on and so forth. So I can't go to sleep today, you see. Got to stay awake. And you know, and so I think that if we have rituals that require us to participate in an awakening, you know, the religious folk, they have little stuff like that. You know, they got little stuff sitting by your bed in the bathroom. You know, sitting by their daily mess to get ready for the day. You see, but we in the African Center movement, we don't have nothing. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
You gotta have rituals that feed consciousness. You know, that empower consciousness. And so as a part of my work, I talk about some of the interventions that we have to engage in. Some of my books, I even outline some of these things. I said, one, we got to have a ceremony for all of us, should have one for all of us, where we break our allegiance with white supremacy domination. So even if we don't break all of our ties at the time of the ceremony, what we do is we make a commitment that we're going to spend the rest of our life breaking them ties. We are not going to maintain this allegiance and continue to perpetuate the white supremacy domination of our people, the continued oppression of our people. So I think it's those kind of conscious reminders that the African-centered movement has to create these kind of interventions that are going to embolden our people to assert an African survival principle, to assert an African cultural sovereignty principle every day. See, we got to do it every day. You know, and I'm just, in my personal life, I do libation every day. I remind myself every day of my commitment and obligation to our ancestors to continue this work every day. You see? And so I think that these are the kind of, but we have to build, we have to institutionalize this. So, you know, not just Cambon's doing it, all of us who are out here involved in this, we got to do this. Because this thing is omnipresent. It is powerful. Oppression. It's complicated. And if we slip, man, if we slip it, it'll you know, digest us again. And then we got to start swimming uphill again. You know, just like the alcoholic who slips up, you know, and that kind of thing. You have to go back to detox. You know, what have you. So I think once we understand what we're up against, then the kind of that will inform the kind of interventions that we creatively, you know, construct to do it. You know, so it's not about, you know, going to some mass meeting or rally all the time. It's about let's create some things that constantly keep us in the battle. You see. Reminders that keep us in the battle, keep us, you know, go to the well and get some more, you know, get some more empowerment so we can go back out there and keep it and remember our charge and stay on task and what have you. So I think, you know, those, and the book, The African Personality in America, that I published in about 1992, I have in the chapter 8, I talk about some of the things we can do to take control of our own personal space as black people, you know. And began to, and it involved those kind of rituals, you know, that we can create, and have to be endorsed by a more African-centered, you know, institutional structure. But these are the kind of things that oppressed and a sophisticated oppressed people must do. See, we keep acting like we high school with this oppression thing. You know, it's been going on all of our lives. We should have learned enough about it, dissected it, so we know how to protect ourselves from it. And how to transform a world beyond it, you see. But again, I you know, those are the kind of things that my work is geared toward, you know, ultimately. And the thing about it, you know, when you have a number of people like myself and we ain't out here for the grandstand and to get all this celebrity and so on and so forth, we're doing the work for our people. So if you're not out there doing that, reaching for the mic and reaching for the camera, our people don't know anything about it. The only time they don't know anything about it is once the enemy recognizes that people are listening to you. Then they're going to give you a platform. They're going to put the cameras on you. That's right. And that kind of thing. But other than that, our people, yeah, they go on, you know, act like that unless you go to Harvard, you know, and then Harvard listen to you, then our people start listening. Somehow we think that the answer to African liberation going to come out of these centers of white domination. That in itself is mental silo. That in itself is culturally misoriented thinking. So I think that ultimately, you know, you get me on my soapbox now, brother. But in terms of, you know, that's the kind of thing that those are the kind of interventions or the way we have to think about intervention in a very clear, practical way, you know, that began to foster the kind of a transformative consciousness that we need that are going to, you know, lead the way in the liberation of our people.
Thank you.
I hope I had something in what I said, you know, that responded to your question.
All of what you said was relevant, and I'm sure there's more, but I appreciate the answer that you gave, and I hope that everyone that's listening understands the magnitude of what you said and the value of what you said, and I thank you.
And I just want to jump in, Doc, and say that in the Hebrew culture that we are resuscitating and resurrecting, that's why we go to the Psalms every day, to the Proverbs every day, and we pull out those wisdoms of the ancients and the elders that have laid down for us that you must say every day and begin to put a kind of value. They switched it to religion, but it's not religion. That's why most black people, especially young black people, stay away from the Bible because they think it's a religious book. It has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with the resuscitation and resurrection of those dry bones that's been laying fallow. So, Sister Janina, you want to open the line for anybody else?
Yes, sir. We have a lot of people that have pushed one, and I'd like to make an announcement for all of you all that push one. Please take your phone off of mute. I'm going to area code 404 and then 708, and then I have a question from the chat line as well. We have a lot of people on the line, so area code 404, I'm opening your mic. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Greetings. This is Sar, Minister Eddie and I in Atlanta, Georgia. It's such a great blessing to be here and hear all these wonderful voices and to hear of us talking about the liberation of our people, not just African people, but all people, humanity, because we're all interconnected. I was listening earlier, and, you know, when you look at our people, you see a people that's so despised by other nations. Isn't it interesting that so many people want to follow us in our clothing, in our food, in our entertainment, in our dance? And the reality is that the whole world is waiting for us to take the lead. The whole world is waiting for us to stand up and to show them, and only can be us, to show them the right ways to eat, the correct ways to educate, the right ways to live and to dress. We have to understand our responsibility to the world. We have to understand our responsibility. Look at how the world shifted in the 1950s and 60s when our strong leaders began to stand everywhere from South Africa to the Caribbean to America. We have to understand the shift that we did to the entire planet, to where we caused countries to rechange their laws and systems based upon the strong leaders in the 60s. So, you know, we have to then awaken that faith spirit. And that spirit's already awakened, especially among the Hebrew communities and some other communities at large that understand our mandate and our responsibility to the world. And that's all I wanted to say thus far.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Sister Janina, back to you.
All right, area code 718. I'm opening up your mic. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Shalom, blessings. Blessings to Prince Asiel, our doctor, to yourself, Sister Tora Rabah, for the form that you have given to us. My name is Benaiah, Brother Benaiah, and like the doctor said, I too was an addict. I was locked into the deception of the American dream, the belief that we can follow the system and get what we need. I am a recoverer. I have no longer been under self-deception, but recognize myself as who I am. The question I have and have been thinking about and pondering as the statement was made before, Sister Yamin, you said something about, the younger brother said, the time is outdated. The message is outdated. But the question I asked to us, and I asked to the doctor specifically, is that with that, looking at how we're moving, what happened to the morale of the young people? Because as you have stated, doctor, that within the past 10, 15 years, or say, five to 10 years, the morale has dropped deeply, that people don't have to care for one another. They're doing segregated things, unbelievable movements and bodies, clothes are becoming less and less. And then how do we address the situation with not just the brothers, but the young daughters who have been traumatized, not just because what we went through in our ancestral past with the slave masters as being taken and raped, but even now our young sisters and young daughters are still dealing with that same traumatic experience. What can we do to continue to resurrect these people to assist in the healing process and the process and the steps to bring back them to their right conscious mind instead of being deceived in the deception where they're at, and let them know that they're children of God, the gods and goddesses?
Should I respond to that? Is that for me to respond
please
to?
That's for you, doctor, please.
Okay. One thing, when we say what's wrong with black children, what's wrong with black young people, my resounding response has to be black adults. They're what's wrong. We're what's wrong with our children. Because we are supposed to be their protectors, their teachers, their all those things we're supposed to be. And if they're not getting it, that means we're failing our children. Now, we obviously know that white supremacy, domination, oppression mitigates, you know, all of this, okay? It mitigates, mediates, and all those things. But we are the big problem. We're the big problem for our children. And if you look at the black community, if the black community is in shambles and whatever, then whoever is assuming the role of black leadership, they are the cause of that. They are responsible for that. And I think that's the hard truth that we have to confront. If we are going to change the direction of our situation toward empowerment and liberation and nation building. So I think that we got to confront that hard, bitter truth that if our children are bleached up, it's because we have bleached them up, or we have been unwitting co-conspirators in bleeping them up, you know, bleeping for the profanity I love to use, you know, in relation to that. So I think that's the first issue. I was invited years ago to a black children conference in D.C., and that was my message then, you know, what's wrong with our children? Let's not be asking out into the universe, out into the sky. Look in the mirror. That's what's wrong with them. We're what's wrong with them. And so I think that we don't, first of all, fundamentally redefine what it means to love black children, what it means to love ourselves. You see, if you love something, you protect it. Man, I mean, you know, you don't even have to, people don't have to wonder, do they really love them? Are they really, I mean, your behavior will say that, you know, in terms of that. I mean, we trust our children to institutions of white domination. We trust them. You know, I've used examples in my classes, you know, over the years. You know, it's like the black parents sit up and, you know, get the little children up in the morning and, you know, get the little Vaseline out. When I was growing up, I'm dating myself, you know, get the little Vaseline out and shine your little face up and tell them you're going out for some great, you know, some great expanded, transformative experience, you know, in life. And the kid is ready. When our kids leave home, they're ready, you know, in those early days, the kindergarten or whatever. They're ready to go out and say, come on, world, I'm ready to take you on. And, man, they're going to assault them psychologically, especially these integrated schools. From the time they step in the room, they start assaulting our children, their value, their worth. And they come home, they don't know. I mean, you sent them there. Hell, you're the one sent them there. You told them something good was getting ready to happen. And maybe they come back, like, you know, start at and like, what the hell just happened? You know what I'm saying? Mom and Dad sent me out there, and I'm going to have something good, and I don't know what happened. You know, it's like a boxer. You know, you get punched so many times in the head, you don't know what happened, what's going on, you know, in about the third or fourth round. And so that's what happened. I think that's a metaphor for what's happening for our children to a large extent when this cycle, because they don't have the interpretive framework to understand and translate what's going on, but we send them out there into it. You see, we endorsed it by our behavior. And so they could go the next day and go the next day. I guess about the 15th day or 15 years later, we get a little monster coming back home. You know, all that crazy stuff didn't work. You follow what I'm saying? You know, we wonder what happened. We started locking our doors on our own children. Hell, we raised them for 18 years. And now we're afraid of them. Something is wrong with us. Something is wrong. We had a power that we didn't exercise. We didn't know we had that power. Remember, earlier I talked about the power to define. You know, putting the power to define back in our hands. That's what African-centered psychology is trying to do for our people. So that we can take charge of our space. You know, our social and cultural space, our psychological space. But we got to know what situation we're in. We got to know what our enemy consists of. We got to know the difference between our enemy and us. If we're going to be able to do that, those are the seedbeds of real acquiring real power, the power to define a reality. And so I think that ultimately this is the issue that confronts us. You know, a lot of my work, my future work, is going to be thrust on that very issue of the children, the implication. I implied a lot of it in the African Personality in America, and I talk a lot about it in the Culture Misorientation book. But I'm trying to look more thoroughly about what should we be doing? What should, you know, an evolving African consciousness look like at, you know, 5 years of age? You know, what should it be an elementary form of it? At 7 years of age, you know, at 10 years, at 12 years of age. You follow what I'm saying? We can give our people some guidelines for what we ought to be trying to, what kind of benchmarks we ought to have, you know, and trying to develop healthy children to do battle, effective battle with white domination.
So is to basically to definitely, as we have done in the community in the morning, is to separate, not to integrate. And because we continue to allow our children to be filled with the Euro-Gentile mentality, it's part and part of what is happening to the children at this day
absolutely.
And age that we're speaking about.
Absolutely.
And with that,
that,
you know,
It's not rocket science.
And I remember back in the days, back in about 10 years ago, when we said we must separate the bills. But I pray, if you can, Doctor, to with your student knowledge and everything else, to give us a blueprint, a program, because I also worked on diligently to separate and to build and teach our children ourselves. But you know, mm-hmm. the system don't like nothing being forth, bringing more forth out there. That's when before charters became popular. Now they have they have diluted the charter system, and then if you don't have a certain amount of hours in the school system, hey, you're still not recognized in that matter in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I pray that the damage of our young brothers and sisters are really deemed from the institutionalized of the European culture.
Absolutely. And the fact that we become perks of it at home. See, it's not just out there in the street. It's not just out there in the street, you know. So that's what makes it so insidious. We're perpetrators of it at home, you see. I mean, that it's coming from these mediums that they actually trust. You know, they're supposed to trust. And here this medium is giving, helping the system, force-feeding them more of this. Or they're not force-feeding. They force-feed it to us in the school. They're feeding it to you with soft music at home, with the context of love and care and concern. So we really gotta. It's gotta be an all-out assault on cosmic orientation in our community. Can't just be looking at one dimension of African, society. It's gotta be a multi-pronged, multi-level, intervention that we're gonna, have to engage in. We're gonna talk a little about it, on Saturday. I just want to talk about layout theory, and then let's look at how do we apply it, how do we operationalize it in specific kind of areas, of the lives of African people. And again, I'm writing things now. I think before I make my transition, I think that's going to be the tightening up part of my legacy. I want to look at applications. How do we take these theories I've been developing over the last 30 years, and now let's see how we operationalize these things in real, concrete, practical ways, to empower our community.
And you took the thought right out of my mind, and I appreciate you, Doctor. And if you, before I depart, if you can give some type of direction on how to heal the pain, especially for our young daughters, which they keep on going through and repeating the same history of our ancestors, on how we can refocus their attention and their self-worth, besides telling them that they're queens and goddesses, what would you say will be a applicable or applicable way to start applying this to the parents to give to the children?
Yeah, I'm not one of those people who subscribe to the different gender kind of things at this point. I agree that there are some things, that we can do, gender-specific things. But oppression knows no gender boundary. I mean, it attacks us, all of us, in fundamental ways, and it manifests itself in all these distortions in our relationships and our self-conceptions, and what have you. And I just don't think we can protect our children, boys or girls, so long as this cultural misorientation, becomes the dominant psychological reality for African people or black people. And so I think that's the thing that we have to do. There's no question that we live in a male chauvinist, male dominant social order, and there are certain subtle privileges. They're limited, they're pseudo, but they're there, that black males have that black females don't have, because it's a gender, it's a male chauvinist, that's what Eurocentric Caucasianism is all about. And so therefore, yeah, those things are true, and they do happen, and we, you know, and but I don't want the Band-Aid approach. I, you know, there are people out there doing that, but I think the ancestors want me to better use my time and intellect and my energy to come up with a much broader solution to our problem, you know, than the Band-Aid. But there are certain things we have to do. If you're bleeding, you got to stop the bleeding. I'm not trying to, you know, in any way demean or suggest that's not important. But we got to have people out there who are beyond that. You know, how do we eliminate the vulnerabilities to the wound, to the, you know, that kind of thing? How do we build in self-protection and so on and so forth? So I think that if we teach race culture consciousness to our girls, it's going to empower them, just like if we teach it to our boys, it's going to empower them. See, in other words, if you make a young girl or young boy believe in themselves as an African person, believe in their value as an African person, then damn it, they're going to require respect toward them from anybody. If they consider them, see themselves as valuable, then they're going to establish some boundaries around themselves that are going to require people come. Are they going to have conflict with them? You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, doctor. Thank you.
So if we can begin to fortify our young people with, you know, in terms of, I don't want to call it a Band-Aid, as an incremental intervention, if we begin to fortify them, you know, with, you know, like what the segregated environment in Alabama gave me. When I came to Chicago at 17 years of old, hell, I didn't question my value as a black person. I mean, that wasn't even on my radar screen. I mean, I knew that. That was a given. Because everything of value that happened to me, it happened through the medium of black people. There was no Caucasian in my life that I could say thanks to so-and-so and so-and-so or coach so-and-so or whatever. None of them. It didn't exist. My whole world was about black people. And so I had nobody else to give credit to for anything that I became but black people, you see. And so I think that my psychological integrity was intact. You know, what all Chicago had to do was polish up my, you know, my race, culture, black nationalist, pan-African nationalist consciousness, you know. So it expanded that power, that basic power that Alabama had given me, that basic, you know, psychological infrastructure, and now made it globally useful to our people, you see, toward the empowerment of our people. But again, you know, I think that anything we can do to our girls or boys to begin to fortify their sense of themselves as a black person, as an African person, their value, their worth, you see, then the greater the fortification, the more that fortification can be a repellent to any anti-African, anti-black, anti-self energy that's going to be floating around in their environment. Am I making sense?
Absolutely. Make all sense in the world. And let me go back to Sister Yaina.
Yes, sir. I have a question from someone in the chat room, and they say, since we're on this topic concerning our state of condition, no matter how you think you understand and have it together, does that also leave us more open to spiritual attack?
Don't understand that question. Does that leave us open? I don't.
Yeah, does that leave us open as a people, since we're a spiritual people and we are being dominated by this culture, does it also leave our minds open to spiritual attack, I think is what they're trying to say.
Well, there are a lot of ways to look at that one. See, one thing about our enemies, they understand enough things about our nature to create an oppressive system that throws us off track in almost every dimension of our nature as African people. And so they take advantage of our, you know, of our spirituality. They take advantage of it. They can strategize in terms of it. You see, the young man who called earlier, I didn't make a comment on it because I really didn't have one to make. When you begin to assign African people, while we're in the midst of oppression, when you give us the assignment to save all of humanity, that's just absurd. That's off the charts. In other words, it's like, well, I got to save the whole neighborhood, and I can't even save my own house. You know what I'm saying? I mean, everything is in increments. We jump the gun. We want to leap. We want absolutes. You know, like television. You get the story, and you can solve it all in 1 hour. You know, that kind of thing. That's not life. That's not reality. It's all incremental. So what we have to do is learn how to control our own house, how to define reality in our own house, define reality in our neighborhood, in our street, define reality. That's how we do that, you see, rather than the sit-up. That's what we've always done. You know, and it's, to me, it's just fallacy. It's not even real. It's not going to work anyway. But we it's like black people assign themselves the assignment to save white people. Hell, we can't even save black people yet. Let's demonstrate that we can save black people. Then we can, if we want to add on other assignments, then we can come back and we can interrogate that strategy, okay? But let's not leapfrog out there because we got some lofty idea about some humanistic mission that we have and so on and so forth when we are an oppressed people. Our first agenda is how in the hell do we eliminate this oppression and transform ourselves beyond it? And so I think that's the danger, you know, when we get into these all these romanticized notions about philosophical notions about humanity and whatever, when the issue is let's start where we are. We're oppressed people. We got enemies out there. The Caucasian world order is anti-black. It is anti-African, period. There's no evidence contrary to it. If it is, bring it out here. Let's lay it on the table. Demonstrate it to us. That's the only evidence we have. And so we got to respond to that because it's killing our people. It's destroying our people. And so, therefore, we must develop responses that are practical. You know, some people say pragmatic. But incremental. They got to be incremental. Let's start with step one, step two, step three, step four. You know, what have you. Let's not try to instantly come up with this solution because that's romanticism. That's delusional. That to me, and as a psychologist, that would be my point of view. So let's get back to, you know, the brass tacks of how do we do this incrementally with a very practical, systematic way because our oppression is very complicated. You know, we love to talk about, you know, the ignorant white people, you know, the ones in the coveralls and chewing tobacco and whatever. And we forget the fact that the white people with the PhDs, you know, with all these titles and all these other things, those are the ones who are driving force in white domination in the universe. You know, there ain't nobody, you know, somebody over there you can make fun of, you know, the black people make fun of and laugh at and so on and so forth. That's not the standard for white domination and white control. That's a distortion. If that's what you're going to focus on. There's instruments of it, you know, to maintain it and what have you. So I think we have to understand that this romanticizing stuff, you know, that we got to go save the world. You know, we are leapfrog the fact that we got to, first of all, let's save our house. Let's save our neighbor. Let's save our city, you know, and so on and so forth. Then when we get to, we are creating an African world order. Now let's see what we want to do with everybody else. But we're jumping way ahead of the game in that regard. I hope that I'm making sense there.
Yes, you are. We have area code 708. 708, go ahead, you're on the air.
I know that area code.
Shalom, shalom. I would think that probably is me. I'm a co-teacher to Natalia. I'm also one of the administrators of the Alma Times. And I just want to say good evening to everyone that came in on the program towards the end. And I just wanted to share some thoughts, your topic of the condition we're in, the state of condition our children are in. I had some conversations earlier about oppression. I happen to be in my profession, educator as well. And some of the things that you're discussing, I totally agree about the mandates or for the you were Gentile mentality or their programs is all for themselves and anti-African American. That's all through curriculum and everywhere we look in America that is being pushed. And so one thing that we do in a charter organization that I'm a part of and can be done by individual teacher, can be done by parents at home as well, is we try to empower students. As you said, students will be pushed to go to school, get an education. They can go through something, come back home, and have a starry eye or some disillusionment about their experience. And that's because they need to communicate what they're really experiencing and not feel like they'll be letting their parents down because they're disenchanted with what their experience is at school. And that means that we have to have open lines of communication, whether we allow those children to be engaged with us in the morning for breakfast or dinner when they come back in. And we want to know how their day went. We want to give them a chance to talk with us, give them other strategies, the other way. So what, one thing we do in the classroom is we have what we call just to raise the conscious back to our African tribal beliefs, our African tribal heritage, is we called it creed, a tribe creed in the classroom. And we had tribe creed agreements to get them back to the start, the idea that we came from tribes. And it was things like attentive listening, a right to pass, but by that right to pass meaning participate, mutual respect to one another, and different rules that you can set forth, hall walls in the classroom or meetings in the classroom to set the culture and the tone, and each student having a right to give their vote or give their beliefs. And towards the end of the school year, I gave an introspection assessment to get the students not to talk about where they're going to go only in the next year or in high school they're going to go to and what they're going to take up or their major or what their interest is or what they're seeking to do, to teach them to step out of the box. But also the self-introspection was to just ask simple questions to get a dialogue going about who do you respect, what do you respect, who is your role model, what do you like about your family, what don't you like about your family, who can you talk to easily when you have a problem? Where do you normally have to go when you need to talk to someone? Then you get to learn more about the student, but you get to understand what they're going through more, because you can look in a person's eyes, look at a person's countenance, a person's spirit, and know that there's something more going on. So as a teacher, a role model, or an adult, you can say, and I have had to do this, what else is going on with you? I've had students come and talk to me personally about personal matters or things that's going on in their home, and we try to deal with those things as well. So when you were speaking about platforms or a program or coming up with agendas or things that we can do as adults that help diminish the situations and the oppression and depression that's going on amongst our people, which is also going amongst adults just as much as it is the children, and the things that we do ourselves as adults, we have to train that to the children. And if we are not doing anything as adults, we're training that anyway. And I just wanted to kind of get in on that and share that. And I have several things that I probably could share going forward in the development of a program, but I just wanted to share those thoughts. And thank you for your time. Shalom.
Thank you.
Madasi, sister. Madasi, I'm impressed anytime we have the courage and audacity to think outside of the box. Just be creative. There are all kinds of things that we can do other than the stuff that's been done that continues to oppress our children. And so anytime we're demonstrating our ability to think creatively, to think independently of the cultural reality that we're in, you know, to create new expectations for our children, new ways of providing interpretive frameworks for our children. Power to you. I applaud you. I salute you. You know, keep up the good work. Because if you keep doing creative and progressive things, you're going to help me get to where we ought to be. You know, but if you're sitting there just trying to replicate what you think they're doing at Harvard or Stanford or some other center of Eurocentric, you know, power, then, you know, all you're doing is being an unwitting co-conspirator and the continued oppression of our people. So I applaud you, you know, what you're doing. You know, keep doing it, keep working at it. I'm sure it's going to expand and, you know, keep evolving and you know, what have you. So again, you know, you're thinking outside the box, and that's the minimal of what I asked for our people in terms of intervention.
Hallelujah.
Well, Doc, we're winding down now to the last 15 minutes or so. And you can take more questions if you want, or you can
No, I think I about run out.
Okay. Then my sister Yanina, I think we can let the doc go and thank him for his time. We went beyond our 45 minutes, but I think that we are the richer for it, and then we can continue the program, you and I, and those who want to call in to discuss ideas and ways in which we can do what the doc has suggested and wrote about, what we can and will do. So thank you, Doc.
Madasi, for having me on. I appreciate it, and I hope I was able to share something of usefulness to your audience.
Hallelujah. Can I ask a question before he hangs up? Could you please announce what the name of your book is and also what is the name of your website or how we can get in contact with you?
Okay. The first question you asked, it bleeped out and I didn't hear it. You said, what's the name of the...
Your book.
The book. Oh, okay, the new one that's coming out. The new one that's coming out is entitled Culture Misorientation and the Psychology of Oppression, the Greatest Threat to the Survival of the Black Race in the 21st Century. That little leg was the same leg in the first edition in 2003. So this is the second edition of that text, and we have about three or four more new chapters that have been added to the original text or the first edition. It'll be out in January 1st, Nubian Nation Publications. Brother Nati at Africa World Books in Baltimore, Maryland. He's our distributor. So you can always, get access to my work through him, through Africa World Books in Baltimore. What was the other question? We don't have a website. You can contact me at the letter K three times, KAMBON at AOL.com. That's my email address. And you can click on Kobe Kamban on Google Kobe Kamban and information about my books and things of that nature. They will come up. They have an extensive list of my works and what have you on online.
Thank you so much, Doc, and have a great night, and see you this weekend.
All right, if people in Chicago, hope to see you this weekend at Saturday at the Community University.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Right.
This is Yanina?
Yes, sir,
Yanina?
I'm right here.
Would
yes, sir,
like,
I'm right here.
Can you
hear me?
Yes, ma'am, would you like to...
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Would you like to
touch
on some of the subjects that Doc talked about and expand from a culture point of view from the Hebraic side of the question?
Absolutely. I think that it's very important that we consider all of the key points that he spoke about today and even Sister Natalia with her comment on what we need to do. I think all of that is important because now it's time to take action. It's time to take action and do something to get the attention of our people. We still have quite a few people on the line and people on the chat line. And I just wanted to make the announcement. If you're still interested in African questions, we still have about 20 minutes left for the show. Please feel free to push one. But I think that it's important that we bring those leaders together and try to involve him in the think tank that we're going to have in Atlanta so that he can come together with the other leaders so we can actually put together a strategy and start implementing those strategies in our neighborhoods and try to get the attention of our parents, especially the young black mothers who are raising children. We're going to have to get their attention because that's where all of the changes will take place.
Absolutely, and you can go to the line if you want to for questions.
All right. Anyone that has a question or concern or you'd like to open up, have some questions for Prince Asiel, please feel free to push one. We have people here, but they're just listening. I think Prince Elrond's mic is open if he wants to elaborate on any of this.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I think another wonderful presentation by a very informed guest, a very qualified guest, and a guest who has our interests at heart. And anytime we can come in contact with each other under those circumstances, then God has blessed us. And I'd like to add something I was listening to on the radio today, and as the doc was saying, when you're on guard or when you know that you got to be looking over both shoulders, et cetera, then you pick up things that are being broadcast from a lot of maybe not obvious directions. I was listening to a sports talk radio show, and they had a guest on who was someone who was well versed in animal behavior, and then one of those guys who had gone all over the world and, you know, investigating and studying animals, et cetera, et cetera. And he was talking about animal behavior as it relates to changes that they make in accordance with their need for survival based on their perception of what's happening to them. By that, I mean, he gave an example of that it's understood in the so-called scientific world that as a phenomena, he gave an example of rattlesnakes. There are rattlesnakes now that don't rattle or they don't announce their presence or they don't announce that they're going to strike. And he said it's in response to human beings exploiting that aspect of their nature and killing them, and they observing that and absorbing that and started behaving, or they went to survival mode and started behaving in a manner that now they're changing their perceived behavior to survive. And so it affects their succeeding generations, which means it changes their DNA. Okay? He also gave an example of another animal. In Kenya, the elephants now, elephants are being born that don't have tusks. If you know anything about the elephant situation, for hundreds of years, they have been hunted and slaughtered for the ivory or their tusks. And so their collective experience and memory now, they've changed themselves or changed their DNA because of their perceptions of the world around them to present themselves in a manner which won't attract this behavior, okay? So we need to be aware of that, too, that the things that the doc was talking about has caused us to change in ways that we are not aware of, and these things have been passed on to our children. So it's very profound what he said. The problem with the children are the parents, but we don't know, sometimes don't understand all of the reasons why we are the problem. So I just want to bring that and add that. I heard that today, and I want to share that because we, too, have been affected by our circumstances, and it has caused us to change our behavior, subvert our nature, and pass that on genetically to our children. Now, if it's not for intervention or if it's not for, as we understand it, intervention and the mercy of God, then we would change and morph into something that would be, from what we were or what we were intended to be, we would be something completely alien or unobservable because the criteria that we were created by would have been changed in lieu of surviving this oppression that's constant for us everywhere we go all over the world day in and day out. So I just wanted to share that and thank you. And again, we thank Prince Asiel for bringing this level of guest to us to cause our minds a shift or consideration of our thought or our approach to things, because it's thoughts that precede everything or every substance. So if we're going to be better, then we have to start thinking better. And if we're going to think better, then we certainly need to help each other on the way.
I have a quick question for both of you. I want to know, because listening to the show today and understanding where the doctor is coming from, don't you think that a lot of that, and 99.9% of that, is we're in the condition that we're in because of the curse? I mean, because, you know, once that's been completely lifted, then our minds will be restored, because there are the Most High has blinded the eyes of Israel, and we're in this captivity, and a part of cultural assimilation means that they completely wipe out our culture, our names, our history, and everything. He's going to restore all of that back. So don't you think, I guess we know what the problem is. Can we do something in advance to change the situation is what I'm asking.
No, Ram, you go ahead, and then I'll respond.
Okay. Now, our situation is not just a curse. Our curse occurred because of our behavior. Okay, so it's not something that we didn't precipitate. And I'm saying that to say that if our behavior changed it from good to bad, our behavior can change it from bad to better. Okay, but first we have to acknowledge that, as the doctor was saying, we have to acknowledge that it's bad because we think it's good in some respect because it talks about us in that shy, in the scriptures where it said, the people said, tell us lies and smooth things. We don't want to hear the truth. We don't want it brought back to mind. We don't have to be, we don't want to be confronted by that. Okay, truth has that ability. I always use the example of when we call ourselves being drunk or getting high or whatever, it was always somebody we would say would come and, for as the doc said, I'm going to use another type of language, that would come and mess up the high because they start talking a certain kind of way. They start talking about certain things. They start acting a certain kind of way, or they would start asking us certain questions that related to truth, which would cause our minds to immediately respond and our bodies to come out from under the whatever we put ourselves under, whether it was drugs, alcohol, or just straight lies. And automatically, the body would start, our minds and our hearts would start responding to truth, and we would be designated as that person who would come. Don't invite him no more. Don't bring him around because he always messes up the high, or he always messes up what we're trying to do, talking that stuff he talks every time he comes around. Okay? So it's not just the curse. The curse is because of our behavior and because we rejected knowledge too. It wasn't just withheld from us. We rejected as well.
Okay. Okay.
That's the point that I want to jump in and say. The word that the doc used was bullshit. And as you know, if you're a farmer, that's used as fertilizer to make something good grow. So Doc was able to take the bullshit of the European deception and begin to look at it, what it could produce on the black fertile mind that had not been developed. And so he went into the institution of higher learning and took the very weapon that was to deceive people and went into it and made people more conscious of the deception by using the very thing. For instance, every black leader, that spoke out, from Marcus Garvey, Nat Turner, all the way up to those that were outwardly murdered, Dr. King, Malcolm, they had to lose their tusks because the next generation of bull leadership was going to be attacked straight up. Now, what I'm saying is that you take, for instance, the Yehuda Nation. They are speaking boldly, but they are coming from a prophetic, spiritual point of view. You don't have to do it the old way. Second thing that Elram told us to be aware of was that person that came when stupidity had taken over the conversation, he would come with truth. And the people would say, oh, man, you're always talking that black stuff. We ain't here to talk that black stuff. Or here you come talking about that God stuff again. We ain't talking about no God up in here. Saying that better world, Yehuda Nation, have morphed into a vehicle that can give people comfort of learning and speaking truth without the antagonism of a natural predator against truth. Because we know you the truth, and the truth will set you and keep you free. So we know the weapon of truth is the most powerful thing that we can learn. And so I'm saying this program designed by Better World Yehuda Nation is to give you truth again. We started off the program, this show, talking about health. We knew that if you don't live long and healthy, you can't even do what it is you want to do.
That's
and
true.
If black people are leading in all of the cancers that destroy the body, the mind, and the spirit, then whatever you know won't be of any use to the children. He told the parents, look in the mirror, and you're going to find out who the problem is. And that's true.
That's true.
Because parents have abrogated their responsibility. Marriage, 4 out of 5 marriages end in divorce in America. And the nation starts with the family. What he said, it's crazy to talk about saving the world and you can't save your son and daughter, your wife, your mother, your father. But you're going to save the world? I'm saying that the source of power that we have is called the remnant. And that remnant was to be that voice to prove that God is the God that we're talking about, the God of Israel is. And I'm saying one family at a time. We're not looking for a mass movement of people to join to indicate that what we are doing makes sense. I remember the Million Man March, where 1 million black men went up to D.C. to hear the minister. And I'm saying, where are they now? What are they doing now? We remember the Million Family March. What are they doing and where are they now? But I remember an organization that started off with 7 black men at Ithaca, New York, at Cornell University, started a fraternity, a brotherhood called Alpha Phi Alpha. And out of it, from that 7 to today, is over 300,000 of the most gifted, most intellectual, strongest black men in the country. And there are others. But I'm saying for sure that started off with 7, and now there are 300,000 of the best and the brightest of black men in America and in the world. So I'm saying let's take the Yehuda Nation, the Better World, Israel, and develop a prophetic standard. That's why I interjected Proverbs. For us to study and become repetition. Because in it are the keys that will maintain the family and the future. And then when we look at the Psalms, we look at those utterances, spiritual utterances to the Creator that will sustain you in the most challenging and difficult days of your life. So I'm going back to the fundamentals of Hebrewism. Know ye the truth, and the truth shall set you, keep you free. It goes back to say, who can find a virtuous woman? For her value is far above gold, and ruby, and diamond. So men ought to be looking for virtuous women, and women ought to be making themselves virtuous to become valuable again, rather than those 3- and 4-letter words that they have been reduced down to. When I started accepting the fact that I was a prince, it changed my behavior. It changed my thinking. It changed my mannerisms. I wanted to be the very best person, best man, best brother, best friend, best husband that I could possibly be. And that's a journey of 1,000 miles. But it starts with the first step, and that is to know yourself and to know the truth. So I'm saying all of those things that we've talked about, let's reduce it down to the family, first the individual, and then the couple, and then the family, and on and on. And watch how we build this strong world again with those small groups. Because if you pay attention to the political news in the world, it says 1% of the population controls 90% of the wealth in the world. 1%.
Wow.
1% now. When we now look at that black people handle trillions of dollars in America for somebody else, where are the black businesses that if black people shopped black, they would be billionaires? If they just bought shoes, if they just bought sunglasses from black people, if they bought peanuts from black people. We doing it all wrong. We trying to be a billionaire before we become a hundredaire.
That's true.
A black man in New York got killed for selling loose cigarettes. He was choked to death. And the police stood around watching him. And he begged, "I can't breathe." Said it 8 or 9 times. And nobody said, "Stop choking the man." And the police was right there. Black people in America are being choked to death because they are conspiring in their own assassination. And you got to stop. So I'm saying every week we're going to try to give pieces of a puzzle to reconstruct a better world in the Yehuda Nation so that God's glory and intellect can shine. Sister Jaina.
Yes, sir. I think that that's absolutely correct. We have to do something. We have to stand up and say no more, because we do. We have a black president in the White House, and our condition has not changed, and our conditions have to change with us first. I mean, we rallied with the young man who was killed. I forgot what his name was. I don't want to forget him. What was that young man's name that was killed in Florida with the Stand Your Ground law, and he got off, and they had rallies.
Trayvon Williams.
Trayvon Martin, and you know, we watched it, and everybody got upset, and they rallied and screamed, but nothing was done. He walked away scot-free, and until we change the mind of our people, because I had a conversation with a gentleman, and he said, "I'm not a slave, I'm free." I said, "You're certainly right, you are. You're free to participate in commerce so that you can make the other nations rich." And until we realize that the freedom that we supposedly or we think we have come with a price, we're never going to change. That is the whole purpose of us doing this, is to let our people know that it is time to stand up. But when we say stand up, what do we do in a situation like that when they're still killing our, when the police are just outwardly assassinating our men? What do we do?
Well, that's easy. You see, do what we do. Do just what we're doing. Put the information out. The right people tuning in to the right station will pick it up. They will know exactly what to do with it. Right now. Keep putting truth into the marketplace.
Okay. All right. Well, I definitely agree with you. And I think that we have to start doing what we've been doing and continue to hope that it'll catch on, because they're doing things and no one's being charged for it. The police are they're walking away scot-free, and it's just a sad situation.
No. I'm asking you, don't look at it like that. I just told you, Aram, are you still on the line?
Yeah, he's still here. One moment, let me open up. Brother Prince Elron?
Yes.
I want to know how many lynchings were at the turn of the 20th century?
From a period of 1886 to 1914, approximately 30 years, there were recorded 2,732 lynchings. In that 30-year period.
And don't nobody even talk about lynching. Now, during that same period, no black people could ride public transportation in the South and in the North. There were restricted covenants of housing. The modern-day version of it is that unemployment among black people 35-40%. So nothing has changed. That young man saying he's free to do what? He wished he could participate in the economy. He don't have a job.
That's true.
Do that? This brother was killed for hustling for his family. He got six children, and he was selling cigarettes loose for 50 cents. And that's against the law in New York City.
Wow.
It brought about death. Not that he was robbing somebody or snatching a purse.
Right.
He was trying to create commerce for himself by selling loose cigarettes, since they cost $10 a pack. He was trying to sell somebody who had this addiction one for 50 cents. And it cost him his life. And he thought he was free by saying, get your hands off me. So I'm saying,
that's true.
Don't do nothing but be that elect and as the spirit of great God has given you, do that and watch it multiply. Stay in your lane. Build the Yehuda Nation.
Hallelujah. Absolutely. I agree 100%. It also reflects the fact that even when we start to create commerce, you still have to stay within the confines of the law.
All you got to do is stay within the confines of what is prophetically proclaimed for us to do. I got out of the wrong lane to think that America had changed and that Africa was free to deal with black people who wanted them to help them be free. And they said, because you didn't say, may I, you had to take them chances. You remember that little game, don't you? Where you had to say, may I, before you could move forward?
Yes.
Yeah.
You still got to say, may I, before you can move forward in America economically.
That's true.
Well, I know.
That's true.
And every time we try to do it differently, we're going to push back. So, my beloved sister, if you go ahead and play us a beautiful song closing us out, I'd be more than happy.
All right, one moment, please. Here we go. It's been a pleasure.
is your girlfriend's favorite DJ. DJ At Low is in the building.
Lead me on, girl, if you must. Take my heart and my love. Take of me all that you want. And if there's a thing that you need,
DJ At Low.
Whenever, wherever, whatever. Baby. Whenever, wherever, whatever. Papa, baby. Wish I knew.
You want to make, you want to say the last word?
Yes, ma'am. I want to thank the listening audience, those who participated in this Better World / Yehuda Nation presentation of truth for the enlightenment and empowerment of our people. And I want to thank you so very much for the opportunity to share with you and our people what we know to be a better world and a better way. Until next week, we thank you so much.